This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. It's 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, May 9th, 2019. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's edition of the program, the future of highway funding in Arkansas. In the latest edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report, two of the state's business leaders offer analysis of the governor's $300 million highway funding plan. That story is coming up later this hour. Coming up later this afternoon on All Things Considered, from Pinterest to Uber, a slew of San Francisco companies are going public this year, creating thousands of new millionaires in one of the least affordable cities. A new city proposal would capture some of that wealth. That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News. You can listen from 3 to 6 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3. The 2019 SEC Men's and Women's Outdoor Track and Field Championships get underway today at John McDonnell Field on the University of Arkansas campus. The women's track and field team is currently ranked number one in the nation. The track meet runs through Saturday, and the final day of the championship will be broadcast live on the SEC network. The Fayetteville City Council is considering a ban on city use of polystyrene foam products. Most of us know polystyrene foam as styrofoam. Teresa Turk, City Council member for Ward 4, sponsored the ordinance and spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about the proposed measure.
Why was sponsoring this ordinance important to you?
Well, I found out that Little Rock had actually passed a styrofoam ban back in November of 2018. And frankly, I was shocked because usually Fayetteville is the leader in these kinds of progressive or environmentally sound movements. So that was really shocking. But I would say that I've had for a long time this notion that Fayetteville is not, that we're lagging behind other states and other cities in how we deal with our waste. I mean, we have some really good, progressive, wonderful things. Curbside recycling is terrific. The solar farm that's going in, that's going to generate 72% of the energy that the city is using. These are terrific things that the city does. But there's other areas where we could really improve. And I thought starting with styrofoam and trying to ban that from any kind of city property or the purchasing from of these materials by the city would be a good start.
So this ban will not affect private businesses, but it will affect the way the city does some of its business. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
This ordinance would actually ban the city government from purchasing any styrofoam products, and also ban vendors that are on city property, such as with Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue and other street vendors, again, that are on city property, from actually using or dispensing styrofoam. The ordinance, if it's passed in 2 weeks, does not go into effect until November 1st. And so I felt like that would give vendors and the city enough time to sort of make an adjustment and to not purchase any more styrofoam products.
So from the vendor standpoint, how would the city actually enforce this rule?
Well, I think that there would probably just be spot checking. I haven't really talked to enforcement about that, but so I'm kind of winging it here. But I think there would be spot checking. And I know that, you know, in general, the city tries to get compliance rather than actually fining people. But so I know it would be a gentle approach in the beginning. Sometimes it just takes a while for people to catch on.
The city council read the ordinance for the first time on Tuesday evening. What came out of that meeting? What did you hear from residents and what did you hear from other city council members?
There were several people there that citizens that really wanted it to be applied citywide, and some council members did too. They thought that this was sort of a limited approach, and it is. But we wanted to make sure that we didn't go too far. And so I think that, you know, there's a possibility in a couple of weeks that maybe we will have a stepwise approach to eliminating styrofoam altogether.
So the ordinance won't come up again until later this month at the city council meeting on May 21st. And that actually is something you asked for.
That's right. You know, I've really been a big proponent of allowing the citizens to hear at least twice in two city council meetings things about rezoning, because people are super busy and it's really hard to track everything that's occurring at the city. And so I wanted to be consistent. So if I asked for two hearings for a rezoning issue, I thought it was important to have two hearings for or two readings for the styrofoam ban. Again, so citizens are aware of it. They may have some ideas about ways to improve it. And so I'm really open to that. I'm open to people's suggestions because, you know, this is a local issue. I mean, it's a global issue, but we're going to implement it locally. And the more people that we have on board, the more creative ideas that we have, the better.
So is the styrofoam ban just a first step? Is there anything else that the city is considering in terms of these environmental measures?
It is a first step, but I have to say this is also trying to fulfill some of my campaign promises. I talked to a lot of people last year when I was running for office, and part of one of my big three ideas was to make the city greener, to green it up. And that means eliminating as much plastic as we can and other non-recyclable products. So I'd like to continue on that and see how this goes. And again, try and implement things that work really well for the community. And then, you know, the other thing, if they eliminate their plastic straws in restaurants, if they eliminate their styrofoam containers, then we don't really have to legislate it. You know, we can be a green city without legislation. There are other methods to make us more green friendly.
Right, because some businesses are already they've already taken that step. A lot of businesses in Fayetteville have eliminated their styrofoam, for example.
Exactly. I think that's great. And I really am going to try and look for a way to reward those kind of businesses. You know, they have a sort of a Green Alliance decal that they use in St. Louis to really identify restaurants that actually are using green methods, zero waste or reduced waste methods. And if we could implement something like that here, or maybe even give an award. So it's really a prestigious thing that you want and draws people to your restaurant or your business because you're using green methods, protocols, and materials, then I think that's another way to sort of incentivize reducing our waste in Fayetteville.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Teresa Turk, the Fayetteville City Council member who represents Ward 4. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek yesterday.
KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2019 Rocklahoma Music Festival, held Memorial Day weekend, May 25th through the 27th, in Pryor, Oklahoma. Over 60 acts will perform, including Disturbed, Bush, Jackal, and Ace Frehley. Winners will be announced Friday, May 17th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Information and registration available at KUAF.com. 91.3 is supported by Entertainment Fort Smith, a monthly magazine with a comprehensive calendar of events covering live performances, dining, home design, lifestyles, and people profiles. Available at over 200 locations and on the web, efortsmith.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Kate Nash was a pop star by the time she was 18. Although she has released platinum-selling records and been on worldwide tours, she's seen her share of difficulties, too. Her manager defrauded her, and she was even homeless for a period of time. Those and other stories are told in a new documentary titled Kate Nash, Underestimate the Girl. The film will be screened this week as part of the Bentonville Film Festival. Director Amy Goldstein and producer Anushka Van Riel stopped by the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio at KUAF yesterday to talk with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. Their conversation began with Amy explaining how she first met Kate.
I first got to know Kate through my hair cutter, We shared the same hairdresser. And Kate was working on getting very hot pink hair for a performance at Coachella, where she was having giant pink vaginas on the stage. And she wanted her hair to match the vaginas. And it was also a very important break for her. She'd become an independent artist, and playing Coachella was huge. And so she wanted to make a big impression. And she wanted to document this. She really wanted, as an independent artist, starting to have a bigger range and a larger voice, to have this documented and how she did it. You know, how was she going to sustain herself outside of being represented by a label?
So what about her story or about her work made you want to actually make that jump and make a film about her?
So after Kate and I met and we got over the vaginas, we talked a lot about the films that were made about women musicians. And all the ones that had been coming out were about people that had tragic deaths, you know, from Amy Winehouse to Janet Joplin to Nina Simone. And they were very sad stories. And it felt like the only way to make a movie about someone in music was they had to die if they were a woman. And we were wondering if we could tell a movie about a woman that was really about survival, so that people would know that you could make music and live and matter and be worth making a movie about. So that was one of the things. I also had been starting to explore making a movie about women in the film business, because so few people get to break through that are female. And it felt very close to home. It felt too, like it would make me too sad, and it was too much my own experience. So telling Kate's story, who was fighting against so many rough statistics, you know, in the music business, and where they're really mean to women, and she was demanding better treatment, that would be a really great movie to make.
So in the course of making this film, did you get to know Kate very well?
So will you if you watch the movie. So Kate went for it. We gave her a camera. The film opens with Kate setting up a camera and starting to film her making a song. And some really, really tough things happened to Kate while we were making this film, and she made the choice to let herself be very vulnerable. So I really mean it. You will know her as well as I do. And it's a very, very intimate film. And I think you feel like it feels very good to be able to be so close to someone. And you're as close while she's making music.
Getting that close to someone, getting that intimate with someone, does it make it more difficult or easier whenever you get into the editing phase of the film?
I think in some ways it makes it harder. I mean, you have more of a responsibility. You're not telling so much an external story and what your film will affect them. Also, while you're filming and painful things are happening from them, you would like to be able to help them, but you can't necessarily, because you're a documentary filmmaker and you really have to give them the space to live their own lives, and you're simply, you know, we made a kind of follow doc of something very verite. You know, we tried to be invisible. And so that's hard too, you know, being invisible when you would love to reach out and help somebody. So, and I guess it's the same feeling in the editing room. You can't help. You can only help by telling their story.
So how did production of this film take place? Was it mostly self-shot, or did you have a crew following you around for a time? Like, what was the actual on-the-ground reality of making this film?
I mean, in all my films, I try to have the subjects film. It's usually only about 10 or 15% of the movie in the end, but it certainly has great intimacy, and you get into rooms that you wouldn't get into with film cameras. So the rest of it, I shot most of it, some big concerts. I was joined by a bunch of people, and a young cinematographer had followed Kate around for years before I began filming. So I was really able to get some of her early life, you know, shot on cameras, not just found in archival, which was amazing.
Just to emphasize the reality of independent filmmaking, where we really, and that's the producer talking, we really struggle to get to maximize every penny. Pretty much AB does cinematography direction, and me, the producer, I produce. I'm my own assistant as well. And I do sound. So we're very light on the ground, which allows for great intimacy as well. But this is pretty much the production crew. And then we, of course, worked with a lot of people in post, and we couldn't have a film without an editor. But it's when you do independent filmmaking, you end up oftentimes doing a lot of things yourself.
I mean, it's grueling. And I often had, we shoot with DSLRs, they're small. I had a couple in a backpack. I'd place them all over rooms or concerts or, you know. But it's physically really hard, and you put in a lot of hours. And Kay was really great to share her schedule, and we'd talk about, you know, what we thought we needed to tell a story. And we film way more in a documentary than you need to use. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a script, so the editing process takes a very long time, and it's where you really find your story. And Caitlin Dixon, who's coming to our Q&A, is the most amazing editor and screenwriter. So we were very lucky.
So when you set out to make this film, what kind of story did you set out to tell? And do you feel like it's the same story that you ended up with?
It's funny because for grants, you have to say what your story is. And we, you know, it hadn't happened yet, so you have to make up stuff. But I think in the essence of the story, we told, you know, we knew we'd make a rock and roll odyssey. We knew we were going to get to go on lots of concert tours with a crazy all-girl punk band. And that, you know, would be explosive. And that we're going to get to see songs made and see the process. We did not know that such difficult things would happen to Kate. And she joked while we were shooting it, like, okay, now you have a movie. You know, we have villains, we have things that do not seem she can get over it. And there was a point where we didn't think we had a movie, that things had gotten so bad for Kate. We stopped filming for a while, and that we weren't sure if she'd find her way out of the mess. And, you know, we gave her the space and time, and she did some miraculous things that are very surprising. So, no, in that specific way, you don't know what the movie is. And we kind of cut two acts and didn't have a third one. And a lot of films don't get finished because it's someone's real life. And, you know, we worked on this for 4.5 years.
When working with someone intimately like you do in this film or other documentaries, do you worry about the subject of the film going through that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you're connected and, you know, and you come to care deeply for them, and you do really worry. There's something about Kate that you worry because you know how much it's hurting her, but you know she'll find a way out. And that's what made Kate so appealing. And that goes again back to our story where she wasn't going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, Kate bounces back and she's so creative and fearless that we all knew, we didn't know what it would look like. She might have ended up teaching music in schools, mm-hmm. which is what her mother wanted her to do. Like, that would have been a very sweet ending. So we just didn't know what form it would take, and we wanted her to not be in pain anymore.
Do you feel that there are any parallels between Kate's story and her experience in the entertainment business and yours?
I do. I think that's why I went from thinking I would make a film maybe about women struggling in the film business to making Kate's story. And I appreciated that it actually wasn't in the film business because it's just too close to home. But we both, I did not have the same meteoric success she had. You know, she made a song and it went platinum, but I had very early success. And there's a certain point that you get to in all these businesses, I think, where you hit certain ceilings. And especially if you want to tell unconventional stories in your songs or in your movies, it's very hard to continue to get them financed. And that's what Kate came up against. She wanted to make the kind of music she really believed in, which for a period of time was punk rock, with an all-girl band. And, you know, she could not get backing until she figured out how to go directly to her own audience. And I, too, am going to have to do the same. So I had to learn from Kate.
How important was it for you to make this movie with a primarily female crew, editors, producers?
Definitely in production, it was super important. And I think being on tour with an all-girl band and being a girl crew, it made it seamless. You know, it made it, and also we just felt so much support for each other. And honestly, the venues were like, you're the crew, you know, and it just kind of spoke of the story all the time. Caitlin Dixon was definitely the editor who wanted to do this and who also felt close to the story. You know, it's just, we like to support women in our business as much as we can, get them as much experience and learn from them as much as we can. So, I mean, we do that on all our movies.
Just in terms of having women on the crew, we don't want to forget the great men that we're on the crew too. We are at a point in history, I guess, where there's still too much gender differences and not enough gender parity, and that's why the Bentonville Film Festival exists. But we have to, I think, also emphasize how many great men with great sensitivities there is out there. And we worked with an amazing, very sensitive sound mixer. We worked with two DPs for concerts who are extraordinary. And,
very... and one of the DPs is the guy who followed her around for years before. And he's, I mean, so I just saw them as wonderful artists. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't have made this film without any of these people. And our assistant editor is a young man who's just loved this movie more than anything. So, but I do, that's why I think it was just in the intimate shooting parts of the shoot that it was really significant. And it allows us to get a different movie we might have had otherwise.
So what do you hope comes from this movie? What do you hope audiences get from it?
I hope artists begin to feel that they can embrace life and they don't need to be so destructive to make art. I hope young girls choose to commit to their work rather than to wanting to be famous and realize what the payoff can be if they put it all into making music or making whatever kind of art they make. I think it's really great to celebrate an artist like Kate who's, you know, stood up for herself and kind of won in doing it. And to take risk, you know, Kate makes a crazy audition tape for Glow, you know, which she probably has a small chance of getting. And due to, it's part of the movie, due to this crazy tape she makes, she gets on a very empowering women TV series where she learns to wrestle, which also drastically changes her. She gets a kind of physicality and a kind of confidence. And she took it to a battle that's in the movie, you know, and she really has to take on and do something that's beyond her abilities. And I think it added, it gave her the confidence to win. So I think it just, if it can get people to be, we're in tough times. And if you can be fearless and not worry so much about the outcome, but be true to yourself, and if people of all ages can feel inspired by the film in that way, I would feel like I did a good job.
That was Amy Goldstein and Anushka Van Riel speaking with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis yesterday afternoon. The film Kate Nash, Underestimate the Girl, will be screened at 1:30 p.m. Friday and at 12:30 p.m. Saturday. Both screenings are at Meteor Guitar Gallery. You can find tickets and more information at BentonvilleFilmFestival.com.
For the Central Arkansas Library System and KUAR, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. With her 1977 ordination at Little Rock's Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, Dr. Peggy Sue Bosmeyer became the first female Episcopal priest south of the Mason-Dixon line. Born in Helena on July 26, 1948, Bosmeyer had served as a deacon in Pine Bluff and an intern curate in Little Rock prior to her ordination. While some said women priests would tear apart the church, and one Episcopal leader stated that we've never had a woman priest back to year one, Arkansas Bishop Christoph Keller Jr. said Bosmeyer's priesthood emphasized not the maleness, but the humanity of Jesus Christ. Bosmeyer became program director for the Diocese of Little Rock and served as full-time vicar of St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Little Rock for 17 years. A gifted and insightful preacher, Bosmeyer was a role model for Episcopalian women throughout the church. She died in 1988, leaving a husband and four children. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
Thanks for tuning in to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Ahead today, a familiar face is returning to Arvest Bank in Benton County, and there's new apartment construction on the way near Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. We'll have details on those stories a little later, but we're going to start off today by hearing from two of the state's business leaders who offer their thoughts on the perennial topic of highway funding. Shannon Newton, who is president and CEO of the Arkansas Trucking Association, and Randy Zook, the president and CEO of the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas, appeared on this week's edition of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock. Their discussion topic was the governor's $300 million highway plan that emerged from the 92nd General Assembly. There was some uncertainty, you may recall, at the start of the session how that program would come together. Here's Shannon Newton and Randy Zook on how the many different groups of stakeholders finally pushed a funding proposal past the finish line, and they'll also offer some analysis of the elements of the funding plan, including the most critical component of all, a permanent half-cent sales tax, which must be approved by voters in 2020.
I think, you know, there was a lot of stakeholders. A lot of people had put a lot of effort into this issue. If you think back, we've been talking about highway funding for at least three or four sessions.
Oh, three or four decades.
Yes, so much so that we kind of got to the point where we stopped asking because we felt like the legislature was tired of hearing about it. And I think just the general swell of the public support actually pushed us over the edge this time. leadership from the governor incorporating it into his campaign and making it one of his four T's. I think that certainly set the stage for the impetus for something to actually happen.
Yeah, Randy, your thoughts on where it kind of originated from and how all those stakeholders got to the table and agreed on something.
Shannon's got it right. It's just public opinion. Look, the experience with the highways, that's the most compelling way to sell the need for highway funding is just let people drive on the roads for a while. We all recognize that we've got roads that are in deteriorating condition and bridges that just have to be replaced that are weight restricted or even marginally safe. So we've got work to do.
When did you know you had a passable solution?
To be honest, I think the 2 or 3 days that led up to the press conference were pretty intense. You had the legislative proposal, you had the governor's proposal, and you had the stakeholders' proposal, and it was somewhat of a Venn diagram of this is how far we're willing to go, and this is what we've got to have to call it a success. And I really think when we stood at the podium, and the governor was there, and Speaker Shepherd was there, and Senator Hindren, and you felt like everybody was going to support this plan. I think at that point, I felt like we were over the hill.
All right. So let's talk about some of the elements of the plan here. You've got the wholesale gas and diesel fuel taxes. You've got the hybrid electric vehicle registration fees. You've got some miscellaneous taxes in there that are going to be pinching from left and right. And the biggie is the half-cent sales tax, making it permanent there. How hard a sell is that going to be?
Well, it's the critical part. It's two-thirds of the total $300
exactly.
million deal. So basically, we've made a one-foot jump on a three-foot ditch so far. So we've got two more feet to go. And it's going to be, I think the people are going to be responsive. I mean, they passed it with a strong margin originally, and I think people are used to paying it. It's not an increase. It's a continuation. So people have seen the benefits of what they invested in or agreed to pay for with the tax through the road improvements that we've had, and more to come, more that's already funded. Just, you know, if we ever start on the I-30 project here in Little Rock, maybe we'll see some more benefit from that.
I'm not trying to be negative, Nelly, but what happens if it doesn't pass? You just play with the money that is there.
Right. Yeah. I think certainly we'd be we would have a highway funding problem again if it didn't pass. You know, Randy alluded to the substantial portion of the plan is the half-cent continuation. But I think based on the research that we've done, based on the results that the people have seen from the current half-cent and the way that it's set up to continue to feed back into the cities and counties so that people can see results, you know, back home, there's no one that's going to be left out of continuing the half-cent. So I think that combination with putting forward a map, putting forward some big projects that will this dedicated funding with the pay-as-you-go system will allow us to project and deliver on a lot of things that matter to a lot of our Kansans.
When do you think we will see what that plan is going to actually look like, what that map is going to look like? I mean, how far away are we from something in that respect?
Gosh, I don't even want to guess. Shannon probably has a better guess.
We've had those conversations, and I know that they're working on it now. I would say no later than the fall. I think, you know, the campaign for the half cent probably will kick off sometime a year out
from
the election.
So who's involved in that process? Obviously, the Highway Commission is going to have to be somewhat of the architects of all that. But how do the stakeholders and the general public, how do they get some input into that?
With respect to the map, is that what you're asking? I think the Highway Department, the Governor's Office has weighed in on some projects that, you know, that they feel are important. And then the Highway Department looks at, you know, where the needs are, where the traffic are, where do we have capacity needs, where do we have maintenance needs, and what it elevates, you know, to the top of the priority list.
They have a really rich data system that tells them where the worst conditions are, and you know, I think they're going to be smart in prioritizing, and obviously the commissioners are going to have some say there, but there's a pretty narrow lane there when it gets down to it. You know, you know where the real work needs to be done.
That's Randy Zook with the State Chamber of Commerce and Shannon Newton, who heads up the Arkansas Trucking Association. They spoke with Roby Brock on this week's edition of Talk Business and Politics. The statewide television program appears every Sunday morning. In Northwest Arkansas, you can tune in at 10:30 a.m. on KFSM 5 News. We'll have more news after this short break. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report on Ozarks at Large.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas, The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's one-comm.com.
Veteran Northwest Arkansas banker Ron Branscombe has started a second stint at Arvest Bank. Branscombe has been hired as a senior vice president overseeing the bank's commercial lenders in Rogers, where it has 8 branch locations. Branscombe was previously the first Northwest Arkansas market president for Batesville chartered The Citizens Bank, which entered the market in 2015 and has 3 offices in the region. Branscombe joined the bank as city president of the Rogers market in June 2017 and was promoted this past September. Branscombe previously worked for Arvest Bank in Benton County from 1998 to 2010, beginning as a senior credit analyst and then working his way up the commercial lending ladder. Branscombe left the banking industry for private business from 2010 to 2017, working as president of a speech therapy company in Rogers called Regional Therapy Services, running the day-to-day operations of a business he owns with his wife Deidre, who launched the company in 2001. And in Springdale, there's new apartment construction on the way near Arvest Ballpark. Fayetteville-based Lindsay Management Company says construction will begin this summer on a new 468-unit apartment community. It's called the Trails at the Crossings. It's a partnership between the Lindsay and George families, who have a long-term business and personal relationship. The site is just west of the ballpark on approximately 22 acres at the northeast corner of Watkins Avenue and South 64th Street. Lindsay Management CEO Lindy Lindsay said the project represents the company's most high-end apartment project to date. The Trails at the Crossings plans to have its first units available in the spring of 2020. And that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report for today. Be sure and follow our reporting online every day at nwabusinessjournal.com. And be sure and follow us on both Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back with more news Sunday morning on the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This week is National Drinking Water Week. Beaver Water District cleans water from Beaver Lake for drinking. Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville then distribute that water to their customers. More information about Beaver Water District available at bwdh20.org.
That's the Fort Smith Chorale, led by William Cromer. They presented their spring concert, Under the Stars, at First United Methodist Church, Tuesday, April 30th. To hear the entire performance, tune in to tonight's Of Note with Katie Hendrickson. That's this evening at 8 o'clock here on KUAF. Thank you. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In 1919, Albert Einstein's theory of relativity had captured the attention of scientists. Some astronomers wanted to test the theory by observing stars during a total eclipse. The result was an expedition from London to Brazil, and planning meant figuring out how to haul large equipment halfway across the world. Dan Kenefick, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Arkansas, has just written an account of the preparation and journey undertaken by astronomers like Arthur Stanley Eddington and Frank Watson Dyson, called No Shadow of a Doubt, the 1919 eclipse that confirmed Einstein's theory of relativity. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Kenefick last week and asked him how the eclipse could be used to prove Einstein's theory.
Because Einstein's theory of relativity, as you may know, deals with what would happen if we were looking at the universe while we were moving very, very quickly, or in the case of his theory of general relativity, in a very intense gravitational field. Nowadays, of course, we would immediately start talking about black holes and things like that. Well, of course, we don't live in a black hole, and we're not moving all that rapidly, so it's not easy to test this theory experimentally, and that was a major challenge in the decades immediately after Einstein published his theory. So he was aware of this issue, and he decided himself, well, I'm going to have to help people out here. I'm going to have to identify ways that we might test the theory. One of them was his insight that light ought to be affected by gravity. At that time, in the 19th century, certainly, people regarded light as this wave propagating through space. It wasn't a material thing, so why would it be affected by gravity? Well, Einstein, as you know, came up with this very famous equation, E equal mc squared. He says, if something has energy, it has mass, according to my equation. We know light has energy, therefore I contend it ought to have mass. If it's affected by gravity, then if I look at a star close to the sun, as the light comes towards me, it'll pass very near the sun, and it should fall towards the sun, and that will deflect it, and that will change the apparent position of the star. So he tells astronomers, starting in 1911 and 12 and 13, you ought to look at stars close to the sun and see if they're in a slightly shifted position. Well, of course, as he himself knew, and as the astronomers quickly informed him, we can't see stars close to the sun because the sun is too bright. And so they all agreed, well, I guess we're going to have to look at it during an eclipse. That's the only time. We're very fortunate on this planet of ours that our moon is just the right size, that it occasionally blots the sun out completely, and then we can see this area of sky quite close to the sun. And the idea was, we'll check if the stars are shifted ever so slightly. It's a very fine measurement, very difficult thing to do. And so that was the prediction that he made. And, of course, it not only took him years to finish the theory, even after he'd had that fundamental insight, but it took even more years than that for astronomers to get on board, get the message, and figure out what they were going to do and make their plans. And they identified, in particular Dyson, who I just mentioned, identified 1919 as the perfect year for this test. Because, of course, it's one thing to have an eclipse, but you'd like to have some bright stars near the sun during that eclipse. And it so happens that that eclipse was the perfect timing. The sun would be in the star field of the Hyades, which is the closest star cluster to Earth, so a number of stars would be right near the sun. And he realized, even though a war was, you know, he realized this in 1917, the First World War was going on, and he knew it was going to be very difficult to get there, probably impossible if the war didn't end in time, but he said, you know, still, we ought to try, because we're not going to get a better opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, so you've got the Great War going on. I am unfamiliar with the equipment you would need in 1919 to do these measurements, but I'm guessing it didn't fit in a pocket.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So you've got to get this. And the other thing about total eclipses is they just don't happen anywhere.
That's right, exactly.
So what did it take?
It took a lot of planning, yes. Now, he was fortunate because in Britain they were accustomed to going on these eclipse expeditions, usually for other reasons, right? This was the first time they were going to test Einstein's theory. But they had what was called a Joint Permanent Eclipse Committee, which was set up by two of England's most famous learned societies, the Royal Society of London — there's no more famous learned society — and the Royal Astronomical Society. And they had decided we'll work together. So they already, for a couple of decades, had been working in this way. And Dyson was the chairman of this committee. That's why I say he was basically in charge. And he said to Eddington, you know more about Einstein's theory than anyone, and you're also an astronomer, so you need to come on board and help me out here. And they identified this eclipse as being perfect for its position in the sky, but unfortunately, the position and the timing on the Earth were less than optimal. The eclipse was due to cross the tropical regions near the equator, South America, and Africa. Much of it would be in mid-Atlantic. That's not much good. Much of it would be over the world's two great jungle basins, the Amazon and the Congo. Not good either, which are heavy astronomical equipment. So in looking for sites, they eventually selected a city in northeastern Brazil called Sobral because it was on the train line from a port they could get there, and an island called Principe off the coast of West Africa. And there weren't many other places. They really were limited in what they could do. And then they were very limited in how they could get there because shipping was suspended during the war. All those ocean liners that would normally sail to Brazil were engaged in war duties. And they really would have been unable to go if the war hadn't ended when it did in November 1918. You can see from their own notes and recollections that they were more or less giving up when the war suddenly ended. A colleague in Brazil tells me that the ship that they went on to Brazil was actually the first passage by an ocean liner after the war. So really, it ended just in time. And then, as if they didn't have enough troubles, the war ended, the big war ended, but a civil war broke out in Portugal in January 1919. So when Eddington set off, he went on the big ship to Brazil, but he got off on the island of Madeira. And he had no idea when he got off on that island how he was going to get from there to Principe because all the shipping in Portugal had been suspended for the Civil War. But luckily, that war turned out to be a very short duration. And after waiting for a month on the island, he finally found a ship to take him on. So one of the remarkable things that I learned as I was researching was that when Eddington started his voyage, he really had no particular idea how he was going to get there.
Wow. And of course, you dock, then you've got to get to the spot.
That's right, yes. And luckily, the people in Principe and in Brazil were very anxious to be of help. The Brazilian government waived customs duties for those big crates full of equipment. People in Brazil, I was there recently, there's a lot of excitement because this is the centenary, and they did. Some of them even said to me, you know, customs must have been a big problem. How did they get through customs so quickly? And it turns out that they had written to the Brazilians and they had arranged for the government to waive inspections. Local people pitched in and helped them select sites. Often there were difficulties. The area of Brazil they were in was going through a severe drought, but luckily the locals knew where there was one well that they could be beside. So they got a lot of help once they reached their locations.
Now, Einstein's theory had sent, I don't know if the right word is shockwaves, but it had really shaken things up among astronomers and scientific community. Any way to know how much in the popular sphere it was?
I think until the eclipse announcement, most people weren't aware of it. Of course, it was all very new. The final version of the theory was only completed in late 1915, so only a few years before. And of course, you have to remember that was right during the war, so even scientists outside of Germany couldn't immediately read his paper because communication with Germany was cut off for those in Allied countries. So Eddington had to write to a colleague in neutral Holland to find out what Einstein's theory was all about. So it really wasn't that widely known. Of course, physicists and astronomers knew something about it. And we do know that Eddington was very excited about the theory. He thought, this looks really interesting. There's every chance that it's right. We really should test it. But we must remember that most astronomers were very skeptical. They were used to theorists coming up with ideas to challenge Newton's great theory of gravity. And in the past, that had always resulted in Newton's theory emerging triumphant when they did do the experimental test. So that's really what they expected. And that was one important thing one reason why I mentioned earlier that I was a little skeptical about this talk about Eddington's bias. I knew that Eddington was quite hopeful that Einstein's theory would turn out to be correct, but every other astronomer that I knew of, and I had looked at some of the correspondence from the period, was very, very skeptical. And sure enough, both Eddington and Dyson in their letters agree that Dyson himself was quite skeptical to begin with. And as I said, he was the one who ended up making the key decision. So I don't think it's quite fair to say that Einstein's theory had sort of seized the scientific imagination. There were one or two people who were excited about it. Most of the others thought, well, this is another newfangled
idea. Here we
go
again.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it something that could be measured, the stars during the total eclipse, immediately, or did there have was there a period of time where you had to do some calculations?
Absolutely, a period of time in which you had to do calculations. One of the most important figures on the expeditions was a man called Charles Davidson. Dyson himself couldn't actually go because of basically important things that he had to be doing at home. And Davidson was his man on the spot. Now, Davidson's original job title at the Greenwich Observatory was computer. In those days,
he was computing.
He was the computing. But in those days, you didn't have an electronic computer. You had a human computer, often a woman. But the Greenwich Observatory paid well enough that they had male computers. Davidson was not only the computer, but he was also the telescope expert, the instrumentational expert. But he and another computer were the ones who did the laborious calculations, which you can see in their notes. Of course, Dyson was working with them, but they were the ones who were doing most of the pen on paper. And that took some time. Eddington was the one who was most excited. He was kind of hopeful that they would get the results out quickly. But of course, as you might expect, it turned out that it wasn't that easy. And I think Dyson always knew, I don't think it's going to be that quick. There was a lot to do. They had to take pictures of the star field during the eclipse, of course. That was the point of going there. But then they also needed to take pictures of the same stars at night, some months before or after, when the sun was no longer in the way, because those were the comparison plates. You had to carefully measure the differences in positions of the two stars. Keep in mind that the shift in position on the plates, it was so tiny that the size of the little blob of emulsion representing the star on the plate was actually bigger than the shift in position. Mm. So they were just looking like at a shift in position from the center of one star to the center of the same star on a slightly different plate. And then they had to do some careful calculations because, of course, the other reason that the star might change position is if the magnification of your telescope changed ever so slightly between those two times, that would, of course, shift the positions too. So they essentially had to calculate for that. And that was the really long and laborious part.
Looking through the papers, was there ever a eureka moment where they said, oh, we've got it? Or did it just slowly kind of add up?
I think it was a little bit of both. Obviously, they had to live with the data for weeks while they worked through it. And they did have some contradictory things to contend with. There were two telescopes used in Brazil. One of those got a result which agreed more with the old Newtonian theory. One of those got a result which agreed more with Einstein's theory. And this, of course, is the reason for this dispute today, right? Were they right to conclude that the telescope that agreed with Einstein was more dependable than the one that agreed with Newton? That's the decision that they had to make. And you can see the spot in their notes where they made that decision. And it's very clear cut. They actually state, they make a very complete, fully worded statement. Often in notes you're a little quick, but here they took their time and they said, well, for these reasons, this is the result of our expedition. And in fact, that quote even made it into the paper written in the notes. And so we can see the calculations that preceded it. We can see that eureka moment when they made the decision. It's worth pointing out that the writing is Dyson's, right? So it's Dyson's handwriting, not Eddington's. And it's also worth pointing out that we can sort of see very clearly why they made the decision, because actually the calculation that preceded that was not a calculation about the good instrument. It was actually a calculation about the bad instrument. And it was clear that they were convincing themselves, this instrument didn't really perform the way it was supposed to. And that happens all the time in science. Normally, what do? If the instrument didn't perform well, you do the experiment again. But, of course, with the eclipse, you can't, right? So all they could say was, then we're not going to take that data. We'll use this other data instead.
Where was Albert Einstein during the eclipse?
Yeah, that's a great question. He was having quite an eventful year. this, of course, is the centenary year right now at the end of April. Both teams were on site at their locations in Brazil and Principe getting their equipment into place. Earlier in the year, in February, Valentine's Day, in fact, they had their last planning meeting before they set off on the trip. That very day, Einstein was in Zurich, Switzerland, getting divorced. He was in the divorce court, getting divorced from his first wife. He had just had a rough few years. His health was poor. His wife, he had been separated for some time. He had to go through this divorce to get to Switzerland to be in the divorce court. He had to more or less escape from Berlin, which was in revolutionary turmoil. The precursors of the Nazis were killing people in the streets. It was a rough start to the year. As the year went on, he knew that the British expeditions were in in train, but he had no idea what was going on. People, as he said in his letters, kept asking him, what's the news? And he would say, well, I don't know, because he wasn't in touch with them. Finally, in September, Eddington gave a sort of a preliminary announcement, and the news was immediately passed on to Einstein through his Dutch friends. The Dutch were kind of the intermediaries. Even at this stage, the war was technically over, but there was still not much communication between the former enemies. And he quickly passed the news on to his mother and made an announcement in the German press. And then in November came the final announcement. Wow. And all of a sudden, Einstein, who was in Berlin at home, found himself a celebrity overnight. It was a staggering change of fortune from the previous difficulties he'd had for the previous few years to suddenly being the talk of the world. He didn't quite appreciate that part of it. He complained. He said, that eclipse expedition ruined my life, basically, because everybody wants to talk to me now. But at the same time, he was as excited as anybody else by the vindication of his ideas.
Dan Kenefick is an associate professor of physics at the University of Arkansas and author of No Shadow of a Doubt, the 1919 eclipse that confirmed Einstein's theory of relativity. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.
The 19th annual Art of Wine Festival presents The Winemaker's Dinner, Thursday, May 16th at 6 p.m. This gourmet evening features wines paired with a six-course meal prepared by Bordino's Restaurant and Wine Bar, a live and silent auction, and more. Tickets available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600. Washington Regional is committed to improving the health of Northwest Arkansas through compassionate, quality care, prevention, and wellness education. As the region's only not-for-profit, community-owned, and locally governed medical system, Washington Regional provides primary care and specialty clinics throughout Northwest Arkansas. WRegional.com for more.
This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Midway, a listener-supported service of the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Kyle Kellums, Zuzana Sitek, and Timothy Dennis, who also mastered our show. Additional content was provided by Paul Gatling. Quick reminder, Columbus House Brewery will be hosting a happy hour fundraiser for us this evening. They're located at 701 West North Street in Fayetteville, and from 4 to 7, a dollar from every pint sold will benefit KUAF. Myself and other KUAF staff members will be in attendance, and we'll have some snacks and sparkling water and, of course, giveaways. So pop in and say hi for a bit tonight. We'd love to see you. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. We'll end today with a song from Goose, recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They will be at George's Majestic Lounge Saturday, and you can find out more at facebook.com/bandgoose. Thanks again for listening, and have a fantastic Thursday.
Thought I'd like it, being on my own. Look around, nothing's familiar. Got your letters. Don't know why I haven't picked up the phone. Afraid to think that I failed ya. And I say, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind. And that means you and why I say, oh no, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, what am I running from? What am I running from? What am I running from? Nothing is chasing me. I just keep going in circles, trying to avoid who I've become. This isn't who I want to be or who I wanted you to see. And I say, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind, and that means you, I say, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind, and that means you, I say, oh no, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, what am I running from? What am I running from? what am I running?